All right, giddy up. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to episode number 2 of Money Mind, brought to you by Digi. Block height is 908,121, and right now you can buy 872 sats for $1. Seems like a really good bargain. Thanks for being here. We appreciate your time and your attention. I'm Nick. I'm here with my co-host, Braden. Braden is the founder and CEO of Digital Commodities, which trades on the Canadian Securities Exchange with the ticker Digi, D-I-G-I. I'm the Bitcoin strategist at Digi, and I lead shareholder education for the company. And this podcast is a forum for us to explore concepts related to money, Bitcoin, and investing. So to start today, we're just gonna do a very brief shareholder update from the week about something we announced. In the first half of the conversation, we're gonna share thoughts about the difference between investing and speculating. And then towards the second half, we're gonna be discussing MNAV. And if you don't know what MNAV is, no worries. We're gonna start by defining it, unpacking it in simple terms, and then we'll dive deeper into the topic. So, small shareholder update. We had a press release on Tuesday. I'm officially the Digi Bitcoin strategist, which is an honor. And thank you, Braden, for giving me this opportunity. I'm very excited. Yeah. We also recruited a social media specialist to help us develop and execute a social media strategy. So you'll be seeing those changes taking effect shortly. Another part of the news is we grew our stack by ironically 21% from 8.69 to 10.54 Bitcoin, which means we crossed the 1 billion sat milestone. Doesn't seem like much because our stack's small, but I think we got to savor it because it's exciting to add another digit to the Digi stack. And adding more numbers to the stack gets exponentially harder. So we got to really marinate on this while it lasts. And one of my roles at Digi is leading shareholder education. So in the future, I'm going to be building out a library of resources, including this podcast, so that our shareholders can develop a deep understanding of Bitcoin, investing, Bitcoin treasury companies. And really the goal there is to create a HODL culture at Digi. And this is our way of contributing to that. So let's talk about investing versus speculating. Braden wrote a book called Money Mind, and the subtitle is Beyond Speculation. So Braden, I'd love to start with just maybe you sharing a bit about why you chose that subtitle, because I think it is very timely. And yeah, would love to hear the story behind that.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for all that, Nick. The subtitle was chosen very consciously because I take a different approach in the stock market, the capital markets, or you could even say the junior markets, which is I really have a true kind of, you know, again, Munger, Buffett, Graham mindset around the cigar butt value investing. That was how I was sort of forged. That's what I understand. That's what I latch onto. I understand fundamental value, scarcity, demand. So that's what drives me. But I'm also, I wouldn't say a gambler, but I'm also a speculator. And in that, I feel like I'm able in my own investing to kind of bridge two worlds, which are eternally different, which is the world of frenetic, manic trading speculation, and the world of deep belly conviction investing, truly investing. So when you can bridge those worlds, that's the magic. So the words beyond speculation really meant, yes, I'm going to YOLO AMC calls, but I have a very, very, very convicted, deep belief as to why I want to go long this right now at this time for this juncture. And again, just kind of crossing over the fact that you're speculating, but you're going much, much deeper. You have a thesis, you have a belief. If you're another example, I like to give myself is if you're mentoring somebody and they ask, well, why did you just YOLO AMC calls? You can very honestly and consciously answer that question. So having a real deep belly belief in what you're buying, what you're speculating on, to me, is the core of smart speculation. So that's the meaning behind that is to go beyond blind gambling and introduce a sort of a concept of almost like value speculation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think informed speculation, you know, it's almost like you have these two contrasts. You have saving and then you have investing. Saving means you're taking the money you have, not taking risk, putting it away into something that's going to preserve the value, hopefully. And so saving is Bitcoin in cold storage. It's the risk-free rate. It's a high risk-free rate now. Mm-hmm. And in contrast to that, investing, along the whole continuum means taking some risk in order to generate a return. And the amount of risk and the amount of information you're using to determine whether that's a risk taking, to me, is sort of the differentiator between investing and speculating. So if someone came up to you and said, what's the fundamental difference between investing and speculating? What differentiates them? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, and then I can kind of share mine.
That is a great question. It's an important question. I have to think about it. I guess I would say the best definition I've ever heard of what is speculation, what is a speculation, is you are going into something with the hopes that something will happen. In essence, that's the core of speculation, is you're investing with the belief that there'll be a catalyst. That'd be another way to say it. So you can speculate on a horse race. You're speculating your horse will win. You can speculate on Apple stock that they'll beat earnings. If you're investing in the Apple stock, you're purely investing for long-term appreciation or dividend or capital gains. You're not investing for something to happen. So when you're speculating in a penny stock, take the junior Canadian mining world as an example, like I get often asked by guys, well, are you involved in any, or do you invest in mining stocks? And I actually surprise people. I say, no, I don't actually invest in mining companies. And they're very confused with that. I go, well, that would be going and buying First Majestic or Pan American to get silver exposure, to get a dividend, as the chart hopefully does very well over the long term. I actually speculate in resource startups that are building PEAs and building resources, to use the mining example. That's a speculation where you're only buying this 5 or 25 cent stock with the hopes that they get something of value and maybe get bought out in the future. That's not an investment. And when people say, again, I like to correct people when they say I invest in the mining space, and then I go, what kind of mining stocks? And then they walk me through it and I go, you're not investing in mining at all. You're speculating on mineral exploration. Incredible. And they kind of, every time they kind of go, oh, I never thought of it like that. So speculation is gambling that something will happen. Investing is putting money to work in trusting that time and performance will provide a return, irregardless of any existing factors. You're not having to rely on a catalyst, therefore your speculation coming true, but rather you're investing in what you see, and it just has to continue to perform. I guess that's my best long answer for you.
Yeah, I like it. That's a good answer. And yeah, I think investing and speculating are both taking, I think the big factors that differentiate the two for me are risk, right? And investing, you're seeking, you know, moderate calculated risk, whereas speculating, you're taking, you know, potentially much higher risk with a much higher potential for reward, but also a much higher potential for significant losses. So risk between those two differentiates them. The basis for decisions, I think, is a big one, right? Investing relies on, you know, time, effort, and energy put into fundamental analysis to actually understand who is running this business, what is the management like, what do they care about, what is the financial strength of this business, what is the, you know, what are the earnings like, what is their cash flow like? Like really deeply understanding the nature of a business and then also the mechanics of the business itself. Whereas speculating really just, I think a lot of times revolves on market psychology or rumors or this hope of getting a huge return for free or in a short period of time. The goal, I think, is different too. So, you know, risk, basis for decisions, the goal, investing really is like a get rich slow strategy, I think. You know, it's wealth building through compounding and consistency, whereas speculating is just, you know, quick gains is, I think, what that chases. And yeah, I think they both involve taking risk for potential rewards, but investing prioritizes stability and growth and is from an informed perspective, whereas speculating is kind of like gambling. And I'm not going to be on my high horse and say people shouldn't gamble. They can do whatever they want. I think it's reckless to gamble a huge portion of your net worth. I also think it's reasonable to take calculated risks with a portion of your net worth. That's my perspective. Maybe some people have a different perspective. But you don't want to just do that blindly, hoping that market volatility is going to fall into your favor with potentially a coin toss or less. Because I think, It's almost like if you're speculating in the market, in the fiat market, it's kind of a rigged game. You can still beat the house. You can still win in blackjack. The likelihood is you're not going to, because there's a lot of people taking a cut, and there's a lot of people that are really well informed, potentially, at a professional level compared to you. And I think the time horizon piece is a big one for me, right? Investing is a long-term game, years to decades. Speculating is short-term, days, weeks, even months. And to me, that's a big differentiator. And I think there's a term in Bitcoin that gets thrown around a lot called time preference. I think it's worth unpacking it very briefly here. So we'll see how I do explaining this. It's a term from behavioral economics. It describes our temporal orientation when we make decisions. So I think the best way to illustrate this is the classic cookie test for delay of gratification. You give a kid two options. Would you rather have one cookie today or two cookies tomorrow? Someone who takes one cookie today has a high time preference. They value the present more than the future. They want instant gratification. That's sort of the speculation hope. Someone who waits to receive two cookies tomorrow has a low time preference. So they value the future more than the present. They're willing to wait to have more. And I think a really critical part of this is that the money that we use is sort of like the control knob on our time preference, whether we realize it or not. So fiat is very high time preference money. It literally decays over time, which nudges humans who engage, who view the world through the fiat lens to engage in high time preference behaviors. Whereas Bitcoin is low time preference money. So it nudges people to low time preference behaviors because what you don't spend today is going to be worth more tomorrow, in the longer term. So yeah, I think time preference is a really big telling part. And I think investing is hard. Here's the thing. It's real easy to gamble, to go and put $500 on a hand of blackjack. That's pretty easy, right? Naively, I think the aspiration of making a quick buck is probably one of the biggest things responsible for separating people from their money. And investing is hard. It requires time, patience, attention, energy. You really got to like put energy into understanding something. And so that's why I think there's fewer investors and more speculators. When everyone gets helicopter money, everyone turns into a wild speculator, especially in an age where everything's getting so expensive and it's like kind of nihilistic when everything's becoming unaffordable. The only way to keep up is to speculate and hope for the 10x return. And again, I think that just fosters people losing a lot of money. But I remember in our first episode, you talked about how when you were seeing the mania of people just, everyone turning into a pocket investor on Robinhood, that was a big impetus for you writing the book Money Mind to bring some reason to this kind of crazy world. And so beyond speculation, knowing that context makes a lot of sense because to me, it was almost like your attempt to share wisdom to help people move away from reckless speculation and move towards understanding the fundamentals of money as energy and what's required to actually make sound investments. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, that's very well said. I guess what comes to mind is that life, in many respects, or certainly the things we do in our job, is a speculation in a sense that I was just thinking how my great grandparents, whose family was in like Oklahoma on the one side of the family for 100 years, they heard that there is this homesteading thing in Saskatchewan, Canada, so they get free land and they come up and they speculate that they can create a farm, grow food cheaper than they can sell it and turn a profit. That's a speculation. Almost everything in life, people always say life's a gamble. That's true to a certain extent, but everything you do, you are ultimately making a decision, speculating that something will occur at a later date. Even getting married and having kids, all these things are forms of speculation. So I think you nailed it on the head that time is the factor, obviously risk tolerance. So if we distill it right down that everyone can understand, if you're John Doe, you walk into BMO, you walk into a retail bank, you say, I've got 10 grand, I want to invest. They sit you down with Bob the banker, and the entire banking system is really just three pieces. When you walk in, they go, okay, well, who are you? What's your age? What are you worth? What's your time horizon? What's your risk tolerance? That's all they need to know. That's the KYC. That's to find out if you're a speculator or an investor. They then say, okay, wonderful. They get all the data. They give you three choices. They pretend there's more, but there's three choices. It's cash equivalents, which is GICs, bonds, savings accounts that you might get 3 to 5% a year, but you will not lose money. So if your time horizon is short term, we want to buy a house next year, we're going to have a baby, we don't want to lose money. Okay, great. We're going to put you in cash. You're going to make nothing, but you're not going to lose anything. If you got a 5-year window, you'll take a little bit of risk. It'll give you the middle, immediate ground, which will be half equities, half cash. Okay, so now you might make 10% a year, and you might lose money if the market crashes, but you're not going to lose the majority of your money if something cataclysmic happens. So the average person, they put down the middle road. Or you go and you say, I've got 25 years to go. This is my long-term money. I'm willing to take some chances. I'm willing to lose money to make 25% a year. They put you in straight equity portfolio and of course fee you to death and make 3% of your money before you do, which is another podcast perhaps. But that's it. The entire banking system is based on three doors, and it's make nothing, lose nothing, make a little, maybe lose a little, potentially make a lot, potentially lose a lot. And the only real factors that they use is what's your time horizon, what's your risk tolerance. So it's an easy way for you to do what, again, Buffett said was just his number one reason for his success over the long haul was asset allocation. Go figure. That's probably the most important factor a new or even seasoned investor can look at is let's now take an Excel sheet or let's create a pie. And here's the $100,000 that I'm worth. Here's five here, five here, five here, 12 here, 10 here, 2 here. Analyze that from above. Make sure that you're carving out your spec money, your play money, your FOMO money, your gambling money accordingly, right? So the asset allocation piece is critical. The time piece is critical. And then most importantly, truly, is sleeping at night, honestly. And so I say that to remind that if somebody goes in and buys Bitcoin for the first time with the only 5 grand that they've got, and it goes down on them and they're down 20%, are they going to lose sleep? And they have to be prepared. They have to acknowledge before they enter, before they leave harbor in the ship, here's all the things that can happen. I can have an amazing scenario, I can have a horrible scenario, I can have a pretty average scenario. How am I going to react? How's it going to affect my life? And ensuring that when you're going into any investment or speculation, that you ask yourself, if this happens, or this happens, what will happen to me and how will I feel? And I think knowing that data is imperative to keep your emotions in check, keep your gut from turning, make sure you're sleeping at night, make sure the wife isn't freaking out and you're not jeopardizing your kids' education. But really just trying to distill it down that it's you kind of see that banking model, I hope, as an easy three-part system of put money in a savings account, make nothing, lose nothing, be down the middle, or you can take a real kind of moonshot. Assuming you have the time, because what does time do? So here's 25 years. Well, in 25 years' time, it doesn't matter if you come down here because you know that it will inevitably get to where you need to be, which is your 10 to 12% a year. I think the S&P's averaged something like 12% a year. Bitcoin significantly better. So again, that's why we're talking today. But first and foremost, and I say this to every person that asks me that says, I want to go buy Costco today. I go, why? How long are you going to hold it? What are you going to do if it halves? What are you going to do if it doubles? You'd be surprised if they never have an answer for those questions. So answer those questions before you set sail, and you will do much, much better, I promise.
Good advice. I think one thing, well, two things that came up. Number one, the more informed you are about something that you're about to put your money into, the less likely you are going to be surprised. Because really, the surprises are what, I mean, the surprises in the bad direction are the really painful ones. The surprises in the upward direction, sometimes people take them and they're great. But the goal, as you know, an informed investor is rarely surprised. I'm not saying never, because there are black swan events that no one can predict. But for example, you go into Bitcoin informed, you've done your research to know that, okay, this is an asset that in any given 4-year period is going to appreciate in a significant amount. In the short term, is highly volatile. It could go down significantly in the short term. If I understand that and I accept that as a trade-off, I'm willing to stomach and go forward with considering the big rewards that I can get over the long term, then that's okay. When it happens, it might still suck. Your emotions are still going to come up. But if you have this educated perspective, you can temper that with reason, and maybe that nudges you to maybe buy a bit more. Or maybe that nudges you to just hold the line because you know that that's part of the plan. That was part of the probabilities. And I know why I bought it, right? The whole thing of why'd you buy it? And then the other thing that came to mind was this idea that, you know, your family speculating that in Saskatchewan there's a better life. And same thing with marriage. You're speculating that this is the woman I want to spend my life with, start a family with. The interesting there is at some point, the speculation actually turns morphs into an investment, right? Once you find the
Oh, I
place in
see. I
Saskatchewan,
see.
you need to invest a shitload of time and energy to
Yeah.
build the homestead, right?
Yeah.
Once you speculate on the right woman, you need to invest a lot of time and energy and love into nurturing this relationship. And to expect that it's just going to build itself or that the marriage is going to work itself out. If you continue the speculative mindset, it might not end well because those might be unreasonable expectations. And so, you know, maybe that's the case with Bitcoin for some people. They speculate initially, like that was the case with me. Someone, a patient of mine, told me about Bitcoin. I speculated, bought a little bit so I could have conversations. And that sucked me into the orbit of Bitcoin and made me become an educated investor by understanding everything from economics to math to physics to energy. And it was like a really cool rabbit hole. So I think there is potential to morph from speculation to investment. And I think just having a clear understanding of how those two things are different doesn't mean you're only going to do one or the other, but it means you can have a more informed perspective and take more reasonable risks and not be surprised and not get screwed over. And I think that's the big thing.
Precisely. A point to make there that's I think again critically important for anyone going into Bitcoin right now. So if you bought yesterday for 118,000 USD, right, against fiat, with the mindset that it better go up, it has to go up, I'm all in. Today it comes down sub 115K, which it did a little bit ago. Your short-term speculation that has to go up just turned you into an involuntary investor. And there's no worse feeling than being trapped in an investment and feeling involuntary versus recognizing yesterday, okay, you know what? I'm gonna start to wade into this investment or this opportunity or this idea. If it goes down tomorrow, fuck, it's on sale. I'm gonna buy more. I'm gonna be elated. So you're not a handcuffed, inadvertent investor converted over from a short-term spec FOMO gambler. So if you choose the right investment and the investment goes down, you should be happy. I think you were actually pleased this morning going, fuck, let's buy more cheaper. So when you buy quality assets and they go down and you're not happy, you're not an investor. Period. You gambled with it only going up with no contingency or plan for it going down. That's an uneducated speculator. That's why I use the word beyond speculation. Pretty simple to me. I mean, again, it's a simple concept when you hear it like that, but that goes to show that when someone goes into something praying and white knuckling that it has to go up, it can turn you into an involuntary shareholder. And there's really nothing worse than holding on to something now, quote unquote, waiting to get even, which is really, again, a lot of the genesis for the book was people going, oh shit, I bought XYZ at the top. What do I do now? Oh, you didn't have a plan. Well, there's no roadmap now because you never had a roadmap to begin with, right?
Yeah. And your mental health will thank you for being informed because it's the lack of understanding that creates anxiety, right? Lack of understanding of when is this going to go up again? And if you have no understanding of the fundamentals of the really the intrinsic value of what you just bought, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for sleepless nights, and it's just silly. And it all comes from this desire to make a quick buck, which I don't think exists. You might hit it off and get lucky on a hand of blackjack and think you're a blackjack genius, but I bet you're gonna lose a bunch of hands and probably lose it all. And so it's almost, I remember one thing you said, it was in your audiobook, was like when big amounts of money come to people who haven't done the work to deserve it, it flees that inhospitable environment. And that really stuck with me because that is, it's almost like speculation is a real, uninformed speculation is a real slippery slope that I think is doomed to crush people. Why? Because they speculate uninformed. It either goes one of two ways. They lose a bunch of money, or they make a bunch of money, reinforces this dopamine decision of just speculate, and they keep doing it out of greed until they get wiped. So either way, it's going to suck. Now, there's still informed speculation with fun money, which there's nothing wrong with. I do it from time to time too. But by my nature, I'm very conservative. So I save most of my money. And the investments I choose to make, I choose because I really want to understand what investment I'm making. it's almost like a forced learning journey of like, I want to understand how business works. So I'm going to learn about these businesses and the fundamentals. And I treat it in a way that like, I want to stay updated. I'm not just going to be there wishfully thinking that it's going to blow through the roof. That's very unlikely. And frankly, if it did happen, I'd probably be worried because I wouldn't have been expecting that. So,
Yeah.
as someone who is the CEO of a publicly traded company, a question that I've been thinking about lately since joining the Digi team, and that I think is worth unpacking together is, what is the archetype of our ideal Digi investor? Who do we want to work for, basically? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, and then I can kind of share the characteristics that are keep coming up for me when I go on a walk and think about that, because I think being clear on that allows us to be clear on what kind of company we want to be, what kind of leaders we want to be, who do we want to work for? At the end of the day, I think it's important to be clear on who you want to work for and what they expect so that you can meet that expectation. So yeah, when you think of what is the archetype of a Digi shareholder that you want to lead the ship for?
Beautiful question. So I'll start to answer that by saying what I truly believe, and there's a lot of great books and I'm sure articles on this topic. The best kept secret, and I would say almost a fundamental law of buying a stock, is that it's not a black and white game. You don't buy and sell a stock. If you do, over the long term, you lose. That's just a fact. So many companies have proven that. So many billionaire funds have proven that. So when a sophisticated investor or a fund wants to accumulate a position of anything, doesn't matter what it is, you don't ever see them go in and clunk in and buy in. Okay, now we hold 10 million shares of XYZ. It doesn't happen. They wade in slowly. And then at a certain point in time, something changes, and then they decide to start to wade back out slowly. So in other words, unsophisticated investors clunk in and clunk out, usually at the wrong time. Intelligent investors accumulate slowly over time as they become more and more educated and convicted and believe in both the macro and the micro situation, or other way around, macro, micro. And then at a certain point in time, when it becomes either overvalued or something changes or the market changes, then they make a decision to distribute back. So, in other words, they don't click sell. They start to exit their position so that if they're wrong and said position starts to go up on them, they haven't just exited out the day before and missed out. They have an opportunity to wait out slowly. So point I'm trying to make is that all of the really, really successful investors that I've met in my life have one thing in common, and it's they build positions slowly for the long term for a whole host of reasons that we've talked about. But the primary reason is that it doesn't matter what the price does after that. It literally doesn't matter. How freeing is that? So you buy a stock on Monday with 1% of what you want to put in that company. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, it collapses. Well, next Monday, you still have 99% of your position to buy, to give an example. So start buying again, maybe even start buying more aggressively because it's cheaper. Or you start buying an investment and it starts rapidly going up on you. Well, you don't chase it. But as you keep buying, keep buying, keep buying, keep buying, you're building a position. That position is getting more valuable every day. And then if it corrects again, you're okay. You're okay if it goes up, you're okay if it goes down. So what a freeing position to be in, where if you start buying XYZ Co and it goes up or it goes down, you're happy. You're literally happy both ways because you're buying it properly. You're accumulating a position. You're wading into the position. So what do our perfect shareholders look like? That's a fascinating, beautiful question. As I said, they're passionate, they're engaged, they're curious, and they are cautious, they're conservative, and they're speculative. So what a dichotomy. They're people that want to be part of something exciting from the beginning, but want to do so alongside educated, honest, authentic, transparent, hardworking, convicted operators. So what's an example of that? If Elon Musk quit Tesla tomorrow, I'll ask you, what would happen to the share price?
It would crank downward, probably.
It would drop. It would gap down. I promise you that. How big, we don't know. Would it halve? Would it quarter? Would it go down by 10%? I guarantee if he steps down tomorrow, expectedly or unexpectedly, the cult of Elon that is contingent on his stewardship of the business will leave the business, just like all the early Apple shareholders did with Jobs. So the point being is that when companies have extreme premiums or extreme discounts, you can only really blame the CEO, good or bad, right? So the my humble opinion, the smaller the company, more so than a bigger business. But in Tesla's case, you could say it's, I think it's valued more than every automaker combined right now,
Which is
which says a
crazy.
lot. Name one CEO of another automaker. I can't. So case in point, but trying to say that we want ones that want to be part of something, but are also critical and intelligent, ask the hard questions, aren't afraid to voice their displeasure. I mean, the best thing about owning a public company is you have a vote. You can show up at the AGM and you can make a real stink. You can oppose compensation plans. You can oppose directors. You can oppose all sorts of things with a very small amount of stock and be fairly disruptive if you want to. That's kind of a beautiful thing. That's the gift of the capital markets for the outside people. So I guess, again, I hope that answers it. It's people that are intelligent but critical and curious but greedy in the true sense of the word, because they're here because they want to make money, and they're here because they don't think they're going to lose money, right? So again, it's a dichotomy, but people that have the view that if the market presents sales or discounts or disconnects, you could say, from anything, be it whatever metric you want to use, above or below, they have the freedom to act accordingly. And they're not going to lose their lunch if the stock triples or if the stock halves. So that to me is a good investor, one that understands, okay, well, I'm building a position because I have trust and faith in management. If that trust or faith diminishes, I might start to distribute my position back. Again, that's the beauty of capital markets. I've myself, just to use an example, I've done this many times. I've bought 10% of companies, tiny companies, over the course of more than a year, and nobody knew I was doing it. The market couldn't see it, and what I was doing was I was trying every day, as I've got more ownership every day, to convince my own self that I want to own a big chunk of this company. And if that company went too cheap or too expensive, again, I would reassess and adjust my plan accordingly if I have to. But yeah, the bottom line is people that understand that, is a company a family heirloom, or is it a hot potato? Is it a car rental, or is it a classic Mustang? And those are two extremes. So obviously we're not talking about heirlooms or rental cars, but those are two ends of a spectrum that I think it's important to say, is this a forever hold in my RSP or IRA? Or is this a literal hot potato that I'm going to log into every morning at 9:30 Eastern and check a quote to see and decide if I'm going to sell it today? We don't want those investors, sadly. I mean, it takes all types, but those type of manic hot potato investors are not investors at all. What they actually are is called stock renters. They rent stock from the market, they hold it temporarily, and they piss it back at a very quick point in time. Now, the market takes all types, it needs liquidity, et cetera. Everyone's important. Renters and flippers are not investors. So I guess that's a differentiator I'd like to just sort of put out there for people that aren't familiar with the concept. But when you say what type of investors you want, I would say investors are the type of investors we want.
Love it. That's a good answer. Yeah, I think the biggest things that came up for me, and this is something I'll think about frequently, and yeah, hopefully the community can give us some good input too, because I'm curious to see how close are we getting to this archetype of investor. A low time preference investor who has a long time scale, who is patient, who is highly informed, who keeps updated on everything we're putting out. An investor who's vocal on socials with giving us feedback and is not hesitant in giving us feedback, whether that's good feedback or things we need to work on. And I, for me, I really the archetype of the investor at Digi is one who cares about BTC yield and is paying us with the primary mission of maximizing sats per share, of maximizing the value that's held in each of the shares, using sats as the unit of account. And that's really a big one for me. And you know, these investors are betting on Digi being successful in the long term. They're betting on the team, they're betting on the fundamentals of Bitcoin. So this investor is curious and informed and still studying Bitcoin. is highly involved with all the updates we put out and is looking at this from like a, 4 to 10 year time horizon. And like I said, really, I'm a shareholder of Digi. I was a shareholder of Digi before I even got involved. And what I care about is taking on some risk with my net worth on investments. And the investments I want to make are the ones that I think have a high probability of outperforming Bitcoin. Otherwise, I would just save it in the risk-free rate of Bitcoin. Why take risk if I can't outperform it? And yeah, I think it's important for us to think about that because then we can attract the right people. I think when you put it out into the universe that this is the kind of person we want to work for, you create a magnetism where those people will show up. And at least you put the signal out to say, this is the kind of company we're part of. This is the kind of investor we're looking for. This is why we want them to have high expectations that we can aspire to live up to. We want them to really care about being involved and care about us being transparent because they're really keen to be involved deeply to know what's going on, right? No quarterly updates, weekly updates. They might not all be big, but they're coming. And when we can say something, we want to say something. We want to let everyone know. Yeah, anything to say to finish off with investing versus speculation before we chat a bit about MNAV?
Well, I guess I would just summarize again, just to really pound the idea into people's heads that are perhaps new to the concept of speculation or to buying sub-dollar stocks, which is you buy a 5 cent stock and the stock goes to 10 cents, or the stock goes to a penny. What do? And I would suggest you get a journal, a piece of paper, and you literally write down, okay, September the stock's 10 cents, what do I do? September the stock's 1 cent, what do I do? First and foremost, it did nothing change in the company. So, in other words, were those conditions external forces? They were the market or something took it up or took it down. Because the reason I say that is if nothing changed foundation in the company, that does change what you do. But you do have to have a little bit of a predetermined notion that if this performs extremely favorably or extremely poorly, what am I going to do? And am I going to consider a 1 cent stock that I bought at 5 on sale or broken? And am I going to consider a 10 cent stock that I bought at 5 cents a great, proof of my amazing abilities or something that's now overvalued? And then again, back to what changed internally. So what changed from an MNAV, what changed from an asset value? All these factors, of course, have to be contributed. So keep that in mind as to what happens. Once something you've entered in, so that you don't have to wake up every morning and go buy, sell, hold, buy, sell, hold, buy, sell, hold, which is what most speculators do, let's be honest.
I think when
And
you're
then
a
I guess I'll just.
speculator, the market, the price of a stock is your primary indicator of value. If you're an investor, the price of a stock is not the
Has
primary indicator
nothing
of
to do with
value.
it. Isn't that ironic? It has nothing to do with anything. It's just a
Right. It the
temporary
price literally
scorecard.
determines if it's on sale or if it's expensive.
That's
But it
all it
doesn't
is.
actually, it's not the determinant of the value because you understand it at a deeper level to make your own assessment and judgment as to what is this worth.
The temporary vote brought on by the market, period.
And the
Yeah, it's
market's a
not.
wild, manic, crazy, whipsaw, emotional, crazy person sometimes. Most of the time, I would argue.
In
So,
most of the time, it's irrational in both directions. It goes too high too quick and too low too quick. It generally overreacts, is another way to say it. The market tends to swing, which is where arbitrage and opportunity comes from, right? But I'll just finalize by saying another great principle. I don't remember where I heard it years ago, and it was the term said to me was 1 hour. I would actually say 4 hours. So every investment you have like this, every speculation, every market-related investment that isn't something like a home or insurance product, give it 4 hours a week minimum of your time for sure. And the reason I say give it 4 hours a week of your time is that if you can't, in other words, you don't have enough time, you might own too many things. And that's a simple measurement, in my humble opinion, to say give it 2 to 4 real hours a week of updates, of educating yourself on what you own. And if you get spread too thin and you now have 25 things and you don't have 100 hours a week plus to do that, you might own too many things. I say that as well
I like
because a
that.
lot of people are in that boat. So give yourself the 4 hour rule and watch how quickly you realize you only need 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 quality investments, speculations at a time. Otherwise, you're spinning plates and you're going to miss opportunity and you're going to make bad decisions.
Yeah, well said. And the last thing I'll say is just that note of the Digi investor using sats as the unit of account. This past week was a beautiful demonstration of why that's important. The fiat price per share of Digi went down. The sats per share went up.
Precisely.
And
The
so if you're
stock market,
measuring
the
value,
share count didn't change either, did it?
no. So if you're measuring value based on the amount of sats you own per share, it just became a much more attractive investment and you're happy because the value, the true value of what you own in those shares went up. If you are using a fiat lens, then the value of those shares went down. And we want the hardcore people that come from Bitcoin and understand what they hold so that when the sats per share goes up, they can feel better about their investment, regardless of what fiat price is doing. Fiat price is just an indicator of whether you should be looking at buying more or holding on or selling some.
And you don't own shares of Digi. You own a tiny percent of a corporation that holds BTC. So
Hard
shifting
assets,
your
yeah.
mindset into, it's a helpful tool that I've used in the past that gave me great comfort was I took my ownership of a company, I divided it by the shares outstanding and went, I own 0.03% of this company. That's kind of cool. And now I know I own 0.03% of this entire company. And I can call the CEO and go, oh, you work for me. In a funny sense, it's you're in the owner's box. So you're not, you might be renting shares, in which case you don't know, you don't care, or you own point X percent of a business, of an underlying asset and all of its assets. You have right on its assets, right? So
It is pretty cool when you think about it. The idea that someone can buy a share of Digi for whatever it is, 5 cents, and say that they own a piece of a company that is engaging in some mission. And if they find that mission important, then for 5 cents, they can be part of that mission. It is pretty
Can
cool.
I
That's the
ask you?
magic of capital markets.
It is, and I'd love to ask you a quick question, if I may.
Please do.
So, let's say devil's advocate. It's a great question out there with Metaplanet and Master and other things. Why would I buy it, Nick? Why wouldn't I just go buy BTC, right? And you understand this, I think, very eloquently. I'm curious your answer for people. I've seen that question posted all over with these treasury companies. You understand the leverage, the torque, and the rationale very well. I'm curious why. Why go buy XYZ Co. versus direct? What's your answer?
Yeah, my concise answer to that is twofold. The reason I would buy a company, like frankly, most traditional investments don't interest me anymore because when you adopt the risk-free rate of, whatever it is right now, 40-50% CAGR of Bitcoin, that's what I can make by saving my money and taking no risk. The only risk is me not being able to steward those sats properly. And if I'm, the caveat there is I'm taking a long-term time horizon. So if I can't make 50% a year on an equity, then I'm not going to invest in it unless I have some, sentimental reason to do so. Maybe it's a company that I started or I'm part of, so I still have equity there. The only reason I'm going to put a portion of my wealth into equity ownership of a company is if I think that that company can generate more sats per share over time. So if I own Bitcoin, if I own 1 million sats, I'm always going to own 1 million sats. I put them in cold storage. If I put it in an ETF, that's a Bitcoin holding company. So the one thing I can be sure of there is I will have less sats as time goes on, right? Maybe it's only 25 bips or 20 bips as the management fee to custody it, which saves me the job of having to keep my keys safe, do my cybersecurity best practices, all that kind of stuff. So some people, that's easier. It's a Bitcoin holding vehicle. I buy a share of IBIT that gives me whatever amount of sats. I will have that amount of sats slightly less every year because I'm paying them to hold it. It's not going to increase for sure. It's going to decrease. If I buy a Bitcoin treasury company that I believe is going to arbitrage the capital markets, the difference between what Bitcoin's appreciating at and what they can borrow money at creates an arbitrage opportunity. If they execute well and can monetize that premium into more sats per share, I'm going to buy equity in that company if I believe that if I start with 1,000 sats in my pro rata amount that I own based on the shares I own, I'm expecting to own more sats as time goes on. And the more confident I am that that company is going to deliver and the faster historical rate they're delivering Bitcoin yield, the bigger premium I'm willing to pay for a share of that company. It must be earned. It must be grounded in logic and reputational history of them doing that, and a belief in me that they're going to continue being able to perform. That's the only reason the only reason I would own a Bitcoin treasury company compared to cold storage is because I've chosen intentionally that a portion of my net worth, I'm going to choose to take on some risk, intelligent risk. And the only way that that risk is worth it is if I think through the framework of sats as my unit of account. Bitcoin is my unit of account. I don't give a shit about fiat because it's a broken ruler. It's always being manipulated. It means very little to nothing to me, apart from just a signal of how quickly fiat's becoming irrelevant. The only reason I'm putting my sats into, because that's the opportunity cost, right? If I put a dollar into a share, it's sats that I can't own. The only reason I'm putting that into a Bitcoin treasury company is if I believe in the company and the team and the mission that they can increase the amount of sats that I own per share over time. That's the only reason. And everyone's going to make their own decision. Everyone has their own risk tolerance. Some people are completely risk averse. All they want to do is put sats in cold storage, risk-free rate. They're saving their money. They're not taking any risk. Kudos to them. Respect. That's what I do with most of my money. I think it's reasonable to do that, especially when you have something that you can save in that gets you a 50% CAGR when measured in fiat bucks. And you should only, I only want to do that if I have the time and bandwidth to actually understand which, because then, okay, even if I made that decision, Braden, I have 160 choices now to choose from, right? Like 2 years ago, I had like three choices or, maybe a dozen choices. Now I have 160 different choices of which equity do I put my money into, which team do I invest into. And it's probably going to be related to which one resonates the most with me in terms of their story and the people, which one has shown a great history of being able to execute efficiently. Which one is well positioned to be the winner in their respective capital market? Because I really think that the Pareto distribution is going to be real visible here eventually, where in every
Absolutely.
capital market, you're going to have, it's a winner
Always
take most game.
is.
And in Japan, I think Metaplanet has secured that. In the United States, or in the world, I should say, I think Strategy's achieved that. And I think it's open season for the Canadian market to have a beautiful competition, collaborative competition between treasury companies to see who gets to. My honest truth is the first one to get to 10,000 sats and can plug into preferreds is going to win because the flywheel starts to spin so fast that no one else can spin up that fast. And on the other hand, I also feel that we're not actually, we do in the short term compete against Belgravia, Matador, all the other Canadian Bitcoin treasury companies. But at the end of the day, we are competing less against each other and more against all of the broken vehicles in the investment space in the capital markets that are underperforming or non-performing in real terms. We're competing against them. It's not even a fair fight, dude. We're competing against them for the dollars that are going to find a better place to live. And so, yeah, in the short term, we compete against each other to see because it's fun. And that competition makes us all push harder, which accelerates the irrelevance of fiat, which is why I'm in it. More so than to make more sats for sure. I want to be part of a community of companies and a company in particular that is accelerating the irrelevance of the thing that is parasitic on humanity. Because I have a daughter that I want to grow up in a better world. That's my why. The way that materializes is I want to find a good team. I want to be able to contribute value. And I want to play this fun game, which is how do we build a beautiful, effective, efficient transformer that brings sucks in fiat currency, transforms it into sound money on the truthful ledger. And in the process, make a lot of shareholders a lot more sats per share they own. So long-winded answer, but investing in a Bitcoin treasury company means you're choosing to take on some risk. You have to decide where you want to allocate that risk. And the only reason I'm taking that risk is because I'm expecting more sats to be generated from that risk than I have right now. Whereas if I put it in cold storage, I'm going to have the same amount of sats. If I put it in an ETF, in a holding wrapper, I'm going to for sure have less sats. And maybe that's worth it depending on where you are on your journey. And the beauty is, I don't actually think those three things are mutually exclusive. I don't think they can, they do to some extent compete for sats. But at the end of the day, I think everyone's going to have their own continuum of how much risk they want to take, how much time they want to put into making good decisions about that risk. And so I think there's a place for some risk in portfolios. There is for me, and that's why I would do it.
That's awesome. Thank you. Can I ask you two more quick questions? Because
You can
I'm very
ask me as
curious.
many questions as you want, dude. You're my boss.
So no, you have a beautiful mind and you see things so clearly in this space because there's so many parallels, or history always rhymes. So I've seen this rodeo so many times with other things as it pertains to the capital markets. And the two-part question I have for you, one is, if you take the analogy of the tortoise and the hare, what, while both are important to sprint and then having the long-term stamina for the marathon, both are critical. You need to be out of the gate, you need to be whole shot ish in the top 3, 5, but you also need to start jogging in a sense that you're going to be able to make the mile, make the 100 miles, right? And I've seen this too lots of times in cycles with various other industries where the sprinter that everybody rushes to inevitably burns out, and then all the little guys, the ankle biters, as it were, end up emerging long term. So I'm curious in terms of the emphasis for a small company like us on the sprint versus the marathon, appeasing the now versus making decisions for the forever. And then I'm curious just myself, you mentioned IBET, and I know you watch BTCT, and we need the Belgravias and the Matadors all to do well. We're all working together here. But as it pertains specifically to BTCT, which as of this morning on my screen had, I want to say, a 67%.
0.67 mNAV.
Well, exactly. It has right now the market cap is 67% of MNAV, so of what they have. So how's that possible? Of course, IBIT tracks a different instrument. Belgravia exceeds, it's a different instrument. What is the disconnect? Because I think I know the answer in a sense that the short answer is Canada, illiquid, quiet, early, people are sleeping, people are not aware. But I'm really curious why you can go in on that particular product, and is it a confidence issue of management? Is it the Evolve company? What is the piece where people just not know about it in the institute? Another, I should say, disclaimer, they did a massive raise institutionally. When you do those, you end up getting a bunch of broker fees and broker warrants and broker commissions. That allows bankers and brokers to sell free stock in it. They worked for, they earned it through commission, blah, blah, blah. But it's still no cost paper. So I do believe that's what we're seeing here. But why do you think the market's asleep when you can buy $8.50 BTCT right now at a discount? I'm curious your thoughts there, and then the marathon piece, if I may.
So what is the what just to be clear on the marathon question, what is the you just want my thoughts on whether it's better to be the rabbit or the
Well,
turtle
no, I
or
guess on a day-to-day, you're making decisions. There's a lot of decisions to make in a public company every single day. Many of them behoove the now and scratch the itch and are the cookie, and many of which are the box of cookies at Christmas time. So how, I guess it, maybe it's an unfair question. How much emphasis, not even us, how much emphasis should companies give now to feeding the ducks, to appease the now, aka stimulation, promotion, going out and yakking versus just hunker down, head down, sats per share, which the market isn't rewarding right now. So that's my point of, oftentimes it's the turtle that wins because he is built for the long haul. But you have to have both. So how do you properly divide your bandwidth to appease the now, the August of 2025, but also ensure that you're leading in 2026 and beyond?
it's a good question.
It's the question. Because, just again, because markets always bring the today question, and then you always have the 30,000-foot view behind that. And it's a constant. I find watching a lot of good market operators is they've found that balance. So I guess maybe again, when I say it's an unfair question, as I interrupted you there, just in terms of who's going to be of the current landscape, lots have jumped out ahead. Is there any sort of, any opinions in your mind as to, if you were to divide your day down by building sats per share, building MNAV, building value of the company versus going out and shouting from the rooftops, hey, we're the best, buy us, right? Because that is a lead of a business's everyday dilemma, essentially, is trying to walk both those lines, right?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, well, I think with that last piece, you have to have something to talk about, right? You can go and shout all you want, but at the end of the day, the actions and the results you're achieving are way louder than going out and just saying words, right? What actually matters? What matters to me as a shareholder is what words is someone saying and what actual results are they delivering? Because someone goes out and spouts, from the highest rooftop, we're going to increase sats per share. I'm like, great. You know what's important? Have you actually increased sats per share? Because if you haven't, I don't give a shit what you say. I care what you do. So I think one of my favorite frameworks for parsing signal from noise, and specifically in my life, determining what am I doing that's not aligned with my current objectives versus what is aligned, is this very clear way of defining traction. We all know the word distraction, right? Opposite of traction, but very few people actually intentionally define traction. So if we internally define traction as increasing sats per share at a competitive growth, so BTC yield basically is traction. If we're increasing the amount of sats our shareholders own per share that they own, that is traction. Everything else, unless it has a tether to that aspiration, is a distraction.
Perfectly said.
And I think there's
Yeah.
going to be seasons, right? Because, talking to banks, investment funds, going out and finding partners, may not, that action itself is not putting more sats on your, like putting more sats per share in the moment. But that is a process in, that is an element in the process to do that. So I think if we're super clear, that's what we want to do. Then we have to be super clear on what plan do we have in place to get there long term? Like, what's our 10-year plan? And I think when I look at the Canadian landscape, there's two big endpoints to this. If it's a marathon, which it is, I'm buckled in for the marathon. I'm not here until next week. I want to stick around for a long time because this is the funnest thing I can think of to do. And I don't see that changing. 10 years, first to 10,000 sats in their stack in the Canadian capital markets. Whichever one comes first. I think the first 10,000 is going to come first because I think things will have seasons where they go real slow, crickets, and where they go real fast. I think in terms of, I think we should run as fast as is responsibly possible without burning out and without getting injured, which to me, burning out is we run out of fuel, we run out of shareholders that believe in what we're doing and believe in it enough in our forward ability to deliver to create a premium on our equity, because that's the only way the flywheel works. If you can't get a premium, if you can't get and maintain a premium on your equity, your flywheel breaks. You're basically IBIT with high management fees.
Yeah,
In
I think
order to
so.
get
Yeah.
that, you got to deliver. There's three premises. You got to deliver big BTC yield. Bitcoin has to appreciate, and you got to be able to execute and convert the premium into more sats per share. This is the flywheel. If it stops, you die, basically. You stagnate. It's really hard to go out of business when you're holding the world's best money, but it's really easy to actually just stagnate and just kind of like trickle along, fart along, and not be in the competition. Why the price discrepancy right now? I seriously think we're so early, dude. Like, we are
Yeah,
in this
me
world.
too.
I'm in this world. I've been in Bitcoin for 10 years. I live, breathe Bitcoin. Everything in my life, aside from being a partner and a parent, revolves around Bitcoin. Because I think it's the only hope we have to get to solve a lot of these problems. Like, all these problems are trickle down
Crisis
problems
we're
for
in right now is exponential. Make no mistake, it is an exponential crisis of fiat debasement. So,
Yeah,
without a doubt.
so I think it's easy to think this is the world, people understand it because we're in it, right? We're in the little sphere. But broadly, you go down the street and you ask someone about Bitcoin, they think it's just one of a million cryptos. You ask someone about a
They
Bitcoin
always say,
treasury
I don't get
company,
it. They say, I don't get it.
yeah,
I
I
hear
don't
that a
get
lot.
it.
I
So
don't
that
get
tells you
it.
how early we are. And
Yeah.
to go even further, I know people that get Bitcoin deeply, really deeply. Like, their unit of account is sats, which is a big transition to Maybe 2 to 3% of people who understand Bitcoin treasury companies. So we're like early on the early, which
Yeah.
is why I think there's such discrepancies right now. I mean, I can say personally, I bought some of the Bitcoin treasury company yesterday because I'm like, I can literally buy this company. This is the ultimate
Discount.
cigar butt from Munger and Buffett, right?
That's yeah.
You can buy a company whereby if the company got liquidated tomorrow, you would receive more assets on a pro rata basis than what you paid for that asset, for that share. I
Minus,
don't.
so this is why I asked the question. Minus humans. So I'm trying to figure out, is there something that I don't see or I don't get? Because there, you go to their website, obviously Raj is a well-known ETF king, huge banker. A lot of people on there. So those are a lot of salaries, I'm assuming. I'm making that assumption. I haven't seen their financials. Those salaries come with management agreements. So if they were to fold tomorrow, and again, please, this is pure, I'm just theoretical. If
Yeah,
they
we're just
fold
thinking out loud.
tomorrow and there's 12 humans that are guaranteed $250,000 a year for the next 5 years, the company goes into CPAA. Now all of a sudden you're not at a discount. So I wonder if the market wonders if that's the case versus IBIT is just an ETF. It doesn't have salaries, doesn't have humans, doesn't have fancy travel or offices, which are the things I always talk about that we don't partake in. We don't do the dog and pony stuff that costs a lot of G&A, a lot of general administrative expense to the company. So that is my question, is what is the disconnect or the lack of trust? Or is it just a straight up absence of participants? Is it just a buyer strike because it's August 1st of peak summer doldrums? So that's, and I have to jump in and say that because when you talk about them folding tomorrow, I literally was going to buy yesterday and I went, I wonder what's going on here there. Because in my personal experience, when I've seen this in the past, and again, let's take them out of the equation. I'm not talking about them. The reason the market, Mr. Market is all knowing a lot of the times. And I had another company many, many years ago. I started accumulating. When it did fold, turned out there was a management agreement where there was all sorts of funky mechanisms where the management themselves had rights to things that I didn't know about as a common layman pleb shareholder. Again, I don't think this is the case. I think it's the evolved family. They know exactly what they're doing. But I wonder if the market knows that or doesn't know that, or what am I missing that it's not a raging buy? Because we are, as you said, in the first inning of a many inning stretch here that arguably is in the warm up. We're still on the bench warming up.
I've gotten used to just being the crazy person. I used to think, I used
Yeah.
to feel crazy because of Bitcoin. Now I've accepted that the world is insane and I feel crazy because I'm the only one tethered into reality. And I've just accepted that. And so that's clearly probably my bias of just thinking, everyone else is wrong still. And there's probably some, clearly I'm
Probably
biased
the
to think that
case.
I'm right. But I've
Probably
had
the case.
good reinforcement.
If it had a US listing, would it be over 1x? I think it would. I think it would. I think
Maybe
that's probably the only reason.
I
And
also
again,
think
I'm
that.
only based on looking at the Canadian landscape, but it's a big head scratcher. And at 8:40, whatever it is, 8:45, I'd be curious when we meet next how that reconciles, because I personally can see it correcting. I can see it going back to 10 bucks or whatever it is. And I wonder. I'm a thinker, and I like to dig like you do. And I wonder if it's the Canadian financial investment bank world as well, where you do these giant greasy financings, and then 16% of that financing ultimately is commission. Well, that 16% dilution translated to free stock in essence, or stock again that doesn't have. If you're giving shares from a financing, that broker's cost, hard cost of those
Zero.
shares is zero. So if they're selling at $8, they're still making money, right? It doesn't matter. They don't wait for 11. They sell at eight, which I think is what's happening. But in
Could
which
be.
case, if it is, that's exciting. That's opportunity. But I'd like it to correct so that I think the Algavias, the Matadors, and us will probably correct as well. So we'll
Yeah,
see.
TBD. I also think that if you look at their purchase acquisition, they made two big purchases, and I don't know, the big purchases are great, big sats per share additions, but I also it's not really laying down a consistent metronomic roadmap of we buy, we buy, we buy. Like part of me wonders, like would it have been better to buy 100 Bitcoin a week instead of 400 in one go? Maybe,
Or
I don't know.
are they this intelligent because they're extraordinarily high level investment bankers in that company? Do they know that everyone's at the cabin right now? I think that's the case. I think they don't want to piss into the wind or shout down a hallway, to use a better analogy, and rather they're saving their bullets for September is my guess. Again, I'm not in any way connected, nor do I know anything. I'm a retail guy as it relates to that thing, just watching it close and hoping it does very well. But it's
TBD,
an interesting
the beauty
bellwether.
is when we keep recording these podcasts, we can go back and revisit, hey, that was a mystery back then, not a mystery anymore.
Hey, we liked it at 8:45. No, not a buy recommendation by any stretch of the imagination. An interesting report card, live report card of the Canadian landscape, if anything. So.
Indeed. All right, let's get into MNAV. It's not going to be a super long discussion, but the reason I want to talk about this is because like 4 years ago, Saylor he reinvented his boring enterprise software company into a new and exciting growth business, which he literally invented and called the Bitcoin Treasury Company, which stands for BTC, ironically. So I like it. And he pioneered a new industry. And I think the reality is most traditional finance people have no idea the truth about Bitcoin or how impactful it's going to be. And they have no idea how to evaluate a business built on something they don't understand. And so, a new industry calls for new metrics to evaluate them and to determine the valuation process. Like, what valuation prices make sense? Which are undervalued? Which are overvalued? In order to determine that, you have to actually have a way to value them. And so, one such metric that is coming out, and actually, maybe even before we go there, quickly just go into some background info that comes from traditional finance that might be useful to create context. So, there's a term in traditional finance called book value. It's a term from value investing. It stands for the net value of assets minus liabilities as recorded on a company's balance sheet. So it represents the theoretical amount shareholders would receive if the company was liquidated. And that's from the book of, Buffett and Munger. If you want to determine if a company is worth buying, if you can buy it below the value of the hard assets that it holds that can be liquidated easily, it's a good buy.
What is scrap value, as I used to say 20 years ago? What's the scrap value? If they sell it off, pay their debts, everybody goes home, what is everyone
What
left
are you
with?
left with? Exactly. So NAV or net asset value, similar concept to book value, differs a bit in context. I think more commonly used for investment funds as expressed on kind of a per share basis. And I will say that there's obviously a lot of depth that you can go into to determine the book value of a company, right? Like even the things you mentioned, like these management contracts or parachutes, those are a factor. All the liabilities must be known in order to really get a sense of that. So it can be a pretty complex evaluation in a big, cumbersome company, but as a really simple way of thinking about it, book value or NAV is an indicator of assets minus liabilities to see whether you're left with a positive or a negative. Then the question is, why would, before we even go into MNAV, which is more of a Bitcoin Treasury Company term, new term, why would a company or fund trade at a premium to its book value? Right? Why would people be willing to pay more for a company than what its book value of assets is worth when you subtract liabilities from assets? And the reason, I think there's a couple of reasons that come to mind. Growth expectations are a big one. So if you're expecting this, for example, the Apple and Amazon trade at massive premiums to what their book value is. The reason people are willing to pay that is one, there's probably not a lot of other alternatives. So you can pay way too much for an equity and it's still a good decision based on the fiat world, different now that there's Bitcoin. Growth expectations, intangible assets, so something like IP or brand reputation, or maybe even just hype from market sentiment. Those might be reasons. So growth expectations, intangible assets, market sentiment, these are all reasons why a company can trade at a premium to its book value. And I think at its core for me, a premium to NAV really just represents investor confidence in future performance, which might be derived from, products that they're going to come out with, growth that they're expected to generate in future, earnings they're expected to generate in future, which is why so many people are paying wacky prices for companies, right? They can rationalize it however they want, but at the end of the day, the reason you're going to pay more than a company's worth right now is because you expect them to be worth more in the future. So that brings up us to MNAV. Now that we know what NAV is, net asset value, MNAV is a new metric that has been created in order to evaluate this new kind of company called the Bitcoin Treasury Company. So it stands for multiple to net asset value. And specifically, we're talking about dividing the market cap of a company by the value of the company's Bitcoin holdings. So this is an imprecise general metric, but I think it does have value because it tells you how much for a Bitcoin treasury company, which I will say is different than a company with a Bitcoin treasury, right? I think all companies will eventually have Bitcoin treasuries. It doesn't make them a Bitcoin treasury company. It means that they're saving in a smart way. Whereas a Bitcoin treasury company is fully focused on increasing sats per share with a competitive Bitcoin yield. That's how I define a Bitcoin treasury company. And so, similar to premium to book value that we talked about before in traditional finance, MNAV represents forward-looking confidence from investors. And for me personally, it represents the confidence that I have in a company that they will keep pace with their historical Bitcoin yield and will continue delivering. Mm-hmm. So the MNAV, and the reason it's really relevant, I think, and then I'd love to hear your thoughts on MNAV and, you know, how, you know, maybe how you think of it as a CEO, like, and again, these are still very new terms. They're going to be iterated, refined. The whole strategy team is thinking, I bet you Saylor is thinking 20 hours a day about this concept of explaining it. And every time I hear him talk about it, it's more refined, more polished. So it's going to get more polished in the future. But I think the relevance for me is that MNAV is a really critical element in the flywheel that determines the long-term success of a Bitcoin treasury company and attracts investors. So it's kind of this virtuous cycle. If you can trade at a premium to your net asset value, people get sucked into the orbit of that company and say, that's attractive, right? It's not that the MNAV, the multiple is attractive, but it's an indicator, right? If a company's trading at a high multiple to the value of their Bitcoin, I wonder why. Why would investors be willing to pay more than the company's worth right now? And usually it has to do with reputation and their ability to generate Bitcoin yield. And a big part of why those companies get bigger and can continue that flywheel is because they have to be able to take that multiple, the premium to book value, the premium to NAV, sorry, and capture it and plug it back into increasing sats per share. That's a really important part of this whole game that's being played. So hopefully that makes sense. I do plan to write an article about MNAV, just sharing my thoughts and whatever we learned from this conversation, put in the investor library, and evolve it over time so that all of our Digi shareholders or people who just want to learn about Bitcoin treasury companies can go in there and learn about MNAV and be involved with our learning process as we continue to learn. So yeah, hopefully that made sense. What are your thoughts on MNAV? What does it mean to you? What's the relevance? We'd just love to hear your general thoughts about it.
Yeah, well, thank you for yours. Very, very informative and hopefully helpful to the viewers as well that might be wondering. Since the beginning of the market, you know, EPS and other ways to gauge is this opportunity attractive or unattractive are imperative. So MNAV, of course, is now the gold standard, and there's actually some new ones that are popping up. I'm sure you're aware as well that some creative analysts have already put forth that are starting to stick, even one similar to EBITDA, which is really PBID, cool.
PBID's the one that I'm going to dive into.
Exactly. So that's really, really fascinating. And money is evolving now, or I should say finance is evolving now in real time. And again, that's an exponential change. So it's critically important. It's important that you understand what it is and what your company's is. They also can be not subjective, but they can be not misleading either. They can, if you go to like the hedge fund business, which has like the concept of pair trading, which would be, you know, I think MicroStrategy is still sub 2, right? Yep. I think Metaplanet's over 4, I want to say. So if you're a real steward of your capital, are you literally shorting MicroStrategy and going long Metaplanet, or pardon me, vice versa? You're shorting Metaplanet to go long MicroStrategy to arb that disconnect or to close that gap, just like going long Coke, short Pepsi, anytime they deviate, as their earnings per share indicates their future value, right? Their time value, money, and all the different ways to factor, is this cheap or expensive? So I think one has to be a little bit cautious just in that example of, well, does that mean that MicroStrategy is the buy? Probably, right? Which one has the more growth? So you have to look at all of the factors. So I think it's critically important that you understand it intimately, you follow it, you follow the changes. We're actually, and thanks to you very much, we actually internally have a Excel sheet right now. It's the Canadian landscape that's live that shows a comp based peer by peer. We can see exactly where we fit with everybody else and have that data real time, which is imperative. As an investor, we need these tools. They are going to continue to evolve. They are the only way to, they're the dipstick of, is my oil at the right level? Is it too high? Is it too low? And they're everything. So as far as my thoughts on it, I think it's just fascinating to me that we're going to get new measurements of valuing BTC companies or Bitcoin treasury companies, because everything is changing. Everything is different now. as you said, most companies will end up having it as an option. And I think once Visa and Barrick Gold and all these companies actually start to wake up to this and do it themselves, not only will they get like the pressure that was given to Microsoft, if you remember, 2, 3 years ago.
I do. And even recently again, too, where they put it up for a
Exactly.
vote.
So once that levy breaks, watch out. And I remember a quote, and someone will have to fact check this one, but because it was in the Toronto Star, it was a financial article, and it was about the TSX Ventures performance, and I never forgot this. And it said that, and I'm gonna try my best to remember, but it said something along the lines that every penny stock that reaches 90 cents will at some point in its near future, I can't remember how long, exceed $2. So what they're saying is there's certain thresholds out there where once something gets past 75 psychological level, dollar psychological level, finds support at a dollar, there's now no reason to think, assuming the underlying foundation is sound and is growing, that it will continue that trajectory to 2 and 3 and so on. So when I look at BTC's price
That's like escape
consolidating at
velocity.
100,
Once you get to escape velocity,
precisely,
it's,
precisely. And
yeah.
it goes back again to the McAfee quote that if it hits 100, it'll hit 1 million. So, which is fascinating. Someone should dig up that article. And it was 90-cent penny stocks have like a 90% probability of seeing $2. Fascinating
Wow.
piece of data going back
Interesting.
on the TSX Venture like 30 years or something like that. So I'll find out. So Toronto Star was like 2007, 2008. It was before the financial crisis. I remember that. So what it was trying to explain was don't buy the stocks that look and appear completely beat up and that are trading at a penny. But if you find ones that are struggling just under a dollar, that can oftentimes be a sweet spot for investors in that particular arena, which was resource exploration. So just a fascinating point, but I forget where I was going with that. I had a reason to bring that up. But anyway, it's interesting times.
Yeah.
And I think again, tracking peer-to-peer is going to be important for us internally. It's very, very important knowing where we are, knowing what's expensive and why, knowing what's cheap and why, and then what's driving the psychology of finance, of course, comes into play. What's driving that discount or that premium? Because as I said with Elon Musk, yes, Tesla is a brilliant company, et cetera, et cetera. It has a visionary behind it. It has a true once-in-a-generation visionary. So that's what's always going to give the premium. Let's pack this company full of visionaries and hopefully not expensive ones that will be able to connect culturally and find the right type of people, be available, maybe even meetups in the future. We do have actually merch going live, which we didn't talk about, which will be kind of nice just to get some hats and tees and hoodies and stuff like that out. And we are in the final stages, hopefully, of having a sort of an ability to show the public our own internal metrics. Let's leave it there as well, so that we have a way to sort of have our own kind of dashboard and where we sit at any point in time. And always open, of course, to feedback and to criticism and comments and encouragement and ideas and anything in between.
Cool. Yeah, new industry, new metrics, new uncharted territory, arguably. Lots of innovation potential in how we measure these companies. I think the last thing I do want to say about MNAV is this idea that in isolation, it actually doesn't tell you a whole lot. It tells you something very cold hard, which is what multiple is the company trading at in terms of market cap to their Bitcoin holdings. But without the context of why that is, it actually is maybe a useless metric. So just note that it's one element, just like your blood pressure is, but in isolation doesn't mean shit. So you have to understand the
That's
context
my
around it.
point. Yeah, that is exactly, and thank you. If I may interrupt quickly, that is exactly my point, is that it's a critically important data set, but without understanding history, there's this great saying where there's history, there's no mystery. Debt levels, debt service ratios, expenses, all of these factors, right down to the focus and the commitment and the drive of the leadership of the company. It's a critical thing, but on its own, it is not the be all end all, that's for sure.
Agreed. So one tool in the tool belt. We'll try and do our best to, share how we're making sense of these things in real time as we do these podcasts. And even on, things like doing X spaces where we can just have open discussions with shareholders or potential shareholders or just people who are following the space, right? And to like listen to how they're thinking of it. What new metrics are they coming across? What is the meaning behind them? How can we integrate that into what we're doing? So, yeah, hopefully that was a valuable discussion, breaking up, investing, speculating, unpacking that a little bit, talking about MNAV, introducing MNAV. Surely it will be an ongoing conversation that we're going to have as time goes on, as we're having insights, as we're learning how this fits into the equation that we're working with at Digi. So thanks for tuning into the Money Mind podcast. There's a lot to do. We have a plan in place. We're super excited to keep you updated and to work our asses off for shareholders. So study Bitcoin, study Digi, stack hats, stack sats, stack health, and ciao for now.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.